Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Shizzy!
No, that's Matthew Sosi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosi.
There, film lovers, welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosi. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it has been a very busy couple of weeks in the Sosi household, and we have lots of information for today's show. In the second half of the program, I know Halloween is over, but it's Halloween week, and some people are celebrating Halloween on Saturday because of the weather. That's the Wayne County folk. But I'm going to replay my interview with filmmaker Jed Bryan, who made the horror film Unlisted Owner, shot in Indiana. Now, I interviewed him earlier this year, so dip into the archives and we'll play that. Why not? And, well, we've got a lot of territory to cover. Starting off, the big film opening this week, Bohemian Rhapsody. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, rock music got it straight out of Compton. It's the story of Queen, their meaning, their rise, Freddie Mercury's downfall and resurgence, even though he was inflicted with AIDS and still a comeback. Anyway, you get the idea. Ladies and gentlemen, I have to tell you, sometimes, you know, you hear the term leave your drama at the door, or save the drama for the stage, and sometimes we go to movies for escape. And sometimes it's all in the timing. If you remember the last time you went to a movie in a foul mood, and then hopefully the film was able to take you out of that. And I had that experience this week in the full disclosure department. We had to put our old cat Curious to sleep on Thursday. And the week before, our cat, Max, was found dead outside. She was also in ill health. So losing two cats in 2 weeks is not fun for anybody. And my daughter and I had to be at the vet when Curious had to go. And so as a distraction, we'd been wanting to see Bohemian Rhapsody. I know this was when the trailer was released. It caused quite a radio gaga amongst the audience. This was what we needed for this evening, that night, hours after we had to do what had to be done. So on paper, I guess I had less of a critical head going into watching this, but it is a standard biopic. It is I've mentioned Straight Outta Compton and any other group involving, you know, you watch things like That Thing You Do and Walk Hard. Especially Walk Hard. Walk Hard kind of destroyed the biopic, but the music biopic. But they still keep making them. because it's kind of cinematic comfort food. You know how it's going to be shot. It reminds me of my buddy Laura Jansen, who said, I don't like biopics because they're movies about people. And what she's saying is she's poking fun at the biopic storyline arc. And I understand that. But that's what this film is. It is a cinematic greatest hits package. It's just done very well. The music's great. People are singing along in the theater. The night we went, they were not near me, so I appreciate that. It's not karaoke. It's a movie. But we got pulled into the story, and we really enjoyed ourselves. It's a good film. It's not a great film. I think it was a really fun experience of a good film. There's a fun moment early on when they record Bohemian Rhapsody, and what they did was they had a series of quotes by critics at the time, not understanding it, calling it self-indulgent. It's kind of like when Rolling Stone bashed Led Zeppelin, and now they're considered one of the greatest rock bands of all time on their list. It's self-indulgent and extravagant and all over the place. We get the group getting together, the friction between Mercury and Brian May and the rest of the group. Mercury's lifestyle getting in the way, going solo, coming back. The other part that is a great sign of good filmmaking is the film, and it's not really a spoiler alert, the film ends with their performance at Live Aid. And I remember seeing Live Aid when it happened. I was 15. And everybody got 20 minutes, and it's a really long, self-indulgent medley of a film, of a sequence in a film. But because the film is about the band Queen, it works. There's a lot of debate about throughout the film of what is Queen, what kind of music is it, and they wanted to be undescribable. They wanted to be unlabeled. They just wanted to be Queen. So when the first couple albums are very, very rock-oriented, and then they want to do something like Bohemian Rhapsody and the album A Night at the Opera. And yes, a bit of stunt casting with Mike Myers as the head of EMI, who makes reference to, who does a Wayne's World joke in the middle of the film. Yuck, yuck. But watching the climax of Live Aid, I was thinking, is this the order that the set list came in when they performed at Live Aid? And sure enough, I checked, and there's a couple songs that they performed in Live Aid that's not in the film, and that's really okay because they were kind of addressed earlier. There's a lot of sequences of where they're arguing over whether it's disco or not, and they want to make it. Freddie wants to do a disco type album, and then the bass line for Another One Bites the Dust shows up. It's that kind of thing. It was much needed, and folks are going to have a really, really good time. And if I see this film a couple weeks or a couple months later, I might be a little more critical. Solid performances. I knew none of the actors. I'm really old and out of it. And I know, especially with Rami Malek playing Freddie Mercury, who does a solid performance. Lucy Boynton is his fiance, who I remember was the girl in Sing Street. Tom Hollander's the only other kind of name of note who plays their manager, Jim Beach, Miami Beach. I know that Mr. Malek was in Stranger Things, which is a program I don't watch. So it was one of those, you have to go to IMDb. I'm like, what else have these people been in? But it's a fun evening of cinema. So even an old fuddy like me enjoyed it and did not mind the format of the band biopic. So go check it out. And with that in mind, let's go back a little bit and revisit, because I jokingly said they didn't cover the band recording the soundtrack to Flash Gordon. I think I need to revisit Flash Gordon. That is a campy cult favorite, and I understand. Queen has been used in music and television over 300 times, according to IMDb. And yeah, the one most noted was they did the soundtrack to the 1980 sci-fi campy classic Flash Gordon. And I know they had songs appear in Iron Eagle and Highlander. That was another one. I think people were acknowledging that. I wrote on my Facebook page, with all due respect to this film, my favorite use of Queen in a movie is not Wayne's World. It's not Highlander, but it's the use of Don't Stop Me Now in Shaun of the Dead. And I know Sean in Muncie said, yeah, I like the Highlander soundtrack. I understand. And yeah, somebody, Mike from Indianapolis said Bohemian Rhapsody in Wayne's World. Yeah. So anyway, good stuff there. Also, opening in theaters this weekend, if the lines are too long for you at Bohemian Rhapsody, ladies and gentlemen, a cinematic wish has been fulfilled. Over the last few years, I have been worried about the film choices of one Melissa McCarthy. Here is a lady who is a big star, and she has been doing very well for herself. Of course, earlier this year, she had Life of the Party and the Happy Time Murders, and now my fear was, what's that Melissa McCarthy film where she falls down? Oh yeah, most of them. Going through a rough patch of films like Tammy and Spy and Life of the Party and The Boss, not the most challenging stuff. And my fear was, I had referred to her as Kevin James with an Oscar nomination because of her fine work in Bridesmaids. And then earlier this year, I see a trailer for a film called Can You Ever Forgive Me? And this is based on the true story of writer Lee Israel, who she was a biographer. Her books weren't selling as much. She couldn't get a new project going with her publisher. And her agent, played by Jane Curtin, and she winds up getting a side job as a woman who was forging documents, letters written by Dorothy Parker and Noel Coward and those things, and it started to develop a living for her. When at a time her work was, as I think the line in the film is, nobody wants to hear from Lee Israel, so she starts creating her own living as a writer, creating false documents. It's an unglamorous performance. You as you see, a lot of, you know, dumpy sweaters and bad hair, and it's set in the late 80s, early 90s. She has some really nice work with Richard E. Grant, who is another down-and-out writer who has an extravagant lifestyle and is her partner in crime. With this is a film directed by Mariel Heller, who is best known for The Diary of a Teenage Girl, among others. And it's not a flashy, but it's a very solid performance from Ms. McCarthy. I watching this with my daughter on Monday. What I said was, with films like Tammy and Life of the Party and The Heat and Identity Thief and a lot of the bigger films that McCarthy is known for, you know, she's the protagonist. You're supposed to root for her, but I use Tammy as an example, but the character was so obnoxious I really couldn't get behind her. And in this, it's kind of similar, except, I mean, Lee Israel at the very beginning is not a nice person. She gets early scene, she gets fired from her job and, you know, is kind of wallowing in her own self-pity. And then there's a moment where she really, really cares, and it's a through line throughout the film. She really, really cares for her sick cat, which also resonated very strongly at the Socie House this week. So the fact is, we know she's not a nice person, as opposed to a film like Tammy or whatever that you're supposed to root from her from the get-go. This was a twist on that. So anyway, I got my wish. I got to see And the other thing was with when you have a comedic actor like a Will Ferrell, like Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love, like Melissa McCarthy in this, there can be some fun moments, and those are sprinkled in between the dramatic moments for levity, and it's a nice film. And the whole kind of sneaking about and trying to make a living doing the forging stuff, and then when the law and the bookstores get tighter and tighter, and there's also a really nice budding romance with McCarthy's character and a woman who runs a bookstore that she is conning, basically. So anyway, it's out there. I got my wish. Thank you. You could still make a few more of these. The last kind of serious performance from Melissa McCarthy was in St. Vincent a few years ago. But ask and eventually you get it. And I got it. So thank you. So yeah, go check out Can You Ever Forgive Me? Also in theaters this week, and this has a Hoosier link to it, is a documentary from Frederick Wiseman called Monrovia, Indiana. Now, Frederick Wiseman, if you've not seen his work, has done documentaries like In Jackson Heights, the National Gallery, at Berkeley, Boxing Gym, The Garden, so on and so forth. He's been doing this a long, long time. And this is a slice of life in small town Indiana, in Monrovia, Indiana. And what his template is, no narration, there's no questions, it's just a camera and you are there. So we get to see activities at a school, at the local cafe, at a street fair, at a board meeting, a park meeting, a wedding, a funeral. So we get all of this slice of life. No narration, no interviews, just kind of voyeuristically peeking in on small town life. And there's nothing wrong with that. Except in my case, the film is 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And that's Mr. Wiseman's films are of this length. This could have been an hour shorter. I got it. I got it early on. And I started to get worried about this number of same shots of a truck passing through past the local bar. As you're watching this, and I don't need to have, it's not a length issue. I want the 5 hour draft of Apocalypse Now. I want the 5 hour Thin Red Line. I think the point was made a long time prior. And you, after a while, I guess, and maybe that's the goal of the filmmaker is, are we going to have a connection between the board meeting and this happening and this town? And there really isn't. So no disrespect to Monrovia, Indiana, the town, it's not 2 hours and 20 minutes worth. 80, 70 minutes would have sufficed. I got it. So sorry. Not really, but sorry. All right. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Speaking of Monrovia, Indiana, the documentary, we'll get to that at the IU Cinema. If you're listening to this on Saturday, you still have time to go down at 4 o'clock and see Goldfinger, and then at 7 o'clock, the documentary Love Gilda about Gilda Radner. Sunday, November 4th at 1 o'clock, The Sting. And at 4 o'clock, National Theater Live's King Lear. Monday, November 5th, Monrovia, Indiana at 7 o'clock as a part of the International Art House series. All 2 hours and 20 minutes of it. Thursday, November 8th as a part of their series involving director Michael Schultz. At 7 o'clock, Thursday, November 8th, the wonderful film Cooley High. For lack of a better comparison, it's called The Black American Graffiti. It's a bunch of young black teenagers in Chicago in the mid-60s. I really enjoy it. So Lawrence Hilton Jacobs is in it, Glenn Turman, Garrett Morris. Really cool soundtrack. And Michael Schultz will be speaking at IU Cinema on Friday the 9th at 7 o'clock, and then at 10 o'clock they're going to show Crush Groove. Saturday the 10th, they will show his film Car Wash at 4 o'clock, and then at 7 o'clock, not a double feature, just two separate screenings, Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood, which would be great to see on the big screen. Sunday, November 11th, The Architect and the Painter Toccata of For Toy Trains, Ames. That's at 1 o'clock on Sunday the 11th. And then at 4 o'clock, the 1950 drama Outrage. Monday, November 12th, Ahrazad Balthazar at 7 o'clock from 1966. So anyway, those are out there. The Tibbs is closed for the season. So thank you for your service. At the Skyline Drive-In at 8 o'clock on the 3rd, Goosebumps 2, and then at 9:45, Venom. I'm not sure if that's the final weekend for the Skyline or not. At new on DVD and Blu-ray, Nicolas Cage's film Mandy, which people tell me I need to see. I need to check on that. The Spy Who Dumped Me with Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon. Princess Bride is out on Blu-ray by Criterion. So those are out there. Also at the Artcraft Theater on Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Saturday, November 3rd, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And then Thursday, November 8th, it's not a movie, but at 7:30 p.m., from the New Mercury Players, Pappy Wilson's Harvest Frolic radio play, musical there. Okay, so those are happening there. Some titles also on DVD and Blu-ray from Film Movement. There's a documentary called Between Land and Sea. And you look at the box and you look at the trailer. It almost has a kind of endless summer feel to it. It's about surfing life. And we've seen these before because you get great surfing footage and you get the life by the ocean is slightly different than being landlocked. But the back of the box says, at times intimate, at times epic. Small town life with epic waves, I guess, is a way of putting it. Only this time, this is happening on the west coast of Ireland. So we meet a few people, some guys who are know that they are past their prime when it comes to surfing. You have one guy who's quit and is going into family life. What kind of impact surfing has on this small Irish coastal town. The guy selling surf equipment. The polar bear that jumps out there whenever possible. By the way, an hour and a half, not 2 hours and 20 minutes. And on top of that, really, really cool footage of the guys on surf. So, yeah, I think it's not just for California anymore when it comes to surfing life. So definitely go check that out. Also from Film Movement, Egon Schiele, Death and the Maiden, and this is the story of the painter. It is not the play or the movie Death and the Maiden, I assure you. But this is on, and pardon my Viennese, with Egon Schiele, who was a scandalous artist in early 20th century Vienna. His stuff caused a stir, even if it's drawings or paintings of nudes. On his bohemian lifestyle also put the question, and this is all before World War I breaks out. So a good film about artists, slightly scandalous, and if you're into that, and a good story there. Okay, Shout Select, Shout Factory has put out on Blu-ray, and I don't think I've seen this since college, but they put out the first City Slickers. It's, I believe, the same information as far as there's a commentary track from Ron Underwood, which I need to listen to, Billy Crystal and Daniel Stern. I believe this was done with the initial video release, and the featurettes are the old ones, but it's a new 4K transfer. And I was in college when this thing came out, and I remember seeing it in the theater there and liking it. And now that I'm older, you have heard me mention before, I have very low tolerance of the woe is me, I'm getting older stories. And that's kind of the engine that drives City Slicker. Billy Crystal, Daniel Stern, and Bruno Kirby are three guys They go out on adventures. You know, we start with the famous running of the bull scene at the beginning, and then they Crystal, who's just turning 39 in this film, and is feeling like life is going nowhere, gets talked into doing a couple weeks at a dude ranch out west, and that's of course where we meet Jack Palance in his Best Supporting Actor winning role, and then doing one arm push ups at the Oscars. But once we get past the "woe is me, I'm 39" portion, and we get the fish out of water story, you get some lovely footage out there. Good banter between Crystal and Stern and Kirby, and also you got that bench of Helen Slater and Josh Mostel and David Paymer and those folks. So yeah, it's a fun little trifle, and sequel not needed at all. So, and then finally, I mentioned a couple of weeks back, Asia Argento's directorial debut, Scarlet Diva, which is now on Film Movement Classic. And it's her, a lot of the film is her just stealing footage on location at various cities throughout the globe. And, you know, an actress who wants to be a director, wants to be taken seriously, and has to deal with the ugliness of the film world, the male film world, and then her own indulgence. And it's very episodic, and it has a kind of low-key, guerrilla, almost Abel Ferrara feel to it. And the film also has, the Blu-ray release had two audio commentaries, both done by Argento, which I finally got around to listening to this week. The one was, I think, right after the film came out, or 2002, I'm sorry. The film came out in the late 90s. So there's a commentary by her in 2002, and then there's a commentary by her earlier this year. She's had a rough one. Between all of the stuff that has happened in her younger days, and I know that she was close with Anthony Bourdain and that whole part, and there's, you know, she was also in the news for being on the receiving, on the giving end of a scandal for alleged sexual assault, and depending on where you listen to stuff, that Bourdain allegedly paid off the accuser, and so anyway, that taints that a little bit. But you also hear a bitter, hurt individual doing these tracks. And she vocalizes a few people. She actually does slam a few people by name. Yes, there's a sequence with a film producer that is based on her encounter with Harvey Weinstein, which she brought up at, I believe, the Cannes Film Festival last year. But hearing her talk a little bit about the film and just kind of airing dirty laundry. Yeah, it's a little gossipy, and but you can hear the pain. But and in lieu of also recent events with her in the headlines earlier this year, very, very complicated. All right, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. I'm your host, Matthew Soucy. This weekend, I'm seeing the podcast of the group The Flophouse, and I did not know this is happening at Earlham College at 7 o'clock. By the time you're listening to this on Saturday, two of the three men involved in this, and it's about cinematic flops, whether it's critical or financial or both. And I believe they are talking about the latest Jurassic World, which I wound up watching. I missed it in theaters, and that was really okay. So I rented it, and then it's an action and thrilling film with no thrills, no surprises. Plus, there was a moment that happens that it involves a soldier played by Ted Levine, one of my favorite That Guys. Yes, he's Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, and he was in Monk, and I loved him as... I always remind folks that he was Mayor Winningham's husband in the underappreciated film Georgia. And it's got me to wondering, and I posted this on Facebook, on my Facebook page yesterday, which actors need to stop being cast as a character who turns on their hero, who betrays their heroes? Because when you saw Ted Levine, I was like, yeah, he's turning. So it's not a surprise to anybody, unless you're an uninformed or uninformed mall crowd. And also the fact that the film also features James Cromwell, and I kept wondering if he was going to turn, because Cromwell, we talk about an unpredictable character turn, him and LA Confidential. So that's the polar opposite. That's when it works. So anyway, I posted that and got a lot of great responses. Brian Hartz, who's been a guest on the show, writes, Tom Hiddleston, Benedict Cumberbatch, Tom Hardy. Really, anybody British is automatically under suspicion for villainy. To which Craig Kemp, who's also been a guest on this show, says, I see, it's like that, is it? Because he's English. John from Indiana writes, Sean Bean and Joey Pantolantonio. Joey Pants, yeah. Michael from Indianapolis writes, F. Murray Abraham, or as I like to call him, film sociology guest F. Murray Abraham. Martin from Indianapolis writes Stanley Tucci. Thomas writes from Indianapolis, Steve Buscemi. And then my buddy Erica says, turn on as in betrays or turn ons as makes them feel kind of funny in their no-no area. Yes, I meant betray. Channing writes Corey Stahl, Chris Lloyd. Well, film yaps, Chris Lloyd. Also writes, whenever Danny Houston first enters the scene, they should practically be a chyline that reads, the villain has arrived. Sean from California. Hi, Sean. He didn't quite answer the question, but he had a great point. He writes, super tired of Ben Mendelsohn as the villain. When I saw the Robin Hood promos, I literally rolled my eyes when he showed up on screen. And then followed up, I realized this unfit the question, but seriously. And I agree, Sean, Ben Mendelsohn needs to star in a frothy romantic comedy really fast. Judy from Illinois writes Helena Bonham Carter. Abdul-Hakim Shabazz wrote me, meaning him, not me. John from Indiana writes Joe Pesci. No, Josh, I'm not reading yours. John also writes Josh Charles, Matt Damon. Jeff from Indiana writes Billy Drago. He's a villain from the get-go. Nick Rogers, who's been on this show, writes Ann Dowd. And then, spoiler alert, brings up Hereditary. Yeah, that's pretty good. Eric from Indianapolis writes Brian Cox. Michael Toulouse from Fine Arts Society also writes Joey Pants. Mike Perry, who's been on this show, Benicio Del Toro, never trusted him, never will. JD from Indianapolis writes Sean Bean. Jeff from Indiana also writes Walton Goggins. Eric from Indianapolis writes Kevin Bacon. I would also add Liev Schreiber to that list. So anyway, that was fun. That's a fun list right there. So, all right, ladies and gentlemen, with that in mind, we'll go back to the archive. We'll dip into the archives and hear my chat with filmmaker Jed Bryan, who made the horror film shot in Indiana called Unlisted Owner. Enjoy. When artists create, whether it's a play or an album or a film, there's some autobiographical background behind it. I'm hesitant to ask you that, but where did your inspiration begin for Unlisted Owner?
Well, for the longest time, I've been a lifelong horror fan. My parents used to take me and my brother to the haunted houses in Evansville, Indiana. And my mom had actually bought me some VHS tapes as a kid of A House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price, the monster movie King Kong versus Godzilla, and always had an interest in horror. But it wasn't until I got into high school and I actually saw the Hostel film by Eli Roth that really got me interested in real life horror and just got me thinking, wow, there's something else out there besides, Jason and Freddy and the typical, monster movies. I mean, there's stuff of, realism that can really scare people. So I started getting ideas of what would scare me and putting them in the script form. And that's kind of how we started to go down the road towards Unlisted Owner.
So there is some autobiographical aspect. I didn't mean this to turn into a therapy session, but, that's fascinating. So, now for those who don't know, I guess, tell the folks a little bit of the story of the film.
Yeah. Unlisted Owner is a feature-length found footage horror film. And for people who don't know what found footage is, it's kind of shot in like a guerrilla style, or you're supposed to try to portray it as events that really happened. In Unlisted Owner's case, It is evidence that's been collected by the fictional Lawford County Sheriff's Department and edited into crime scene evidence. Basically, the film follows a group of friends who hear about a family of five that is murdered in a house about a mile away from where they're planning to camp at for the night. And they actually go to the house, and there's police cars and ambulances there, and they're pulling a body out. And they decide that they're still going to go on their camping trip, but through a series of bad decisions, they end up back at the house after their curiosity gets perked, and that's when all the fun begins.
Well, yes, I think the term is horror movie decisions at times have to be made.
Yes, exactly.
Now, of course, found footage kind of became a subgenre because of the Blair Witch Project, and there's been a number of them from paranormal to, you know, all the others. But you have a particular spin on the concept of found footage. Where did that come about? And tell folks what it is.
Yeah, I decided to make it like edited as crime scene evidence. I hadn't really seen that in a found footage film before, and I kind of wanted to give it that realistic aspect to it. And another reason we decided to go that route too was we put these evidence placards so people can know who has the camera. I know there's several other found footage films where you're jumping back and forth between different cameras, and you're kind of like not sure who's holding the camera or what point of view I'm looking at. So we put these evidence placards in there to kind of better help people understand who has control of the camera at that point in time in the story. We also did a series of blend edits to be able to make shorter scenes. Usually in found footage, the people who control the camera, they do these hard edits where it stops and it may jump like 5 minutes ahead or 30 seconds ahead. So I wanted to kind of eliminate that as much as I could. So we did a lot of scenes to where it looks like they go on forever, but there's actually like four or five edits within those takes. And actually there's some scenes that look like, well, it's just seamless, but it was like 3 or 4 months in between shooting.
I know other examples of that is like Alfred Hitchcock's Rope or Birdman, where you find little areas that you can do that splice that you know where it is, and if you're a big movie nerd like this host, you can find them. But for the general audience, it flows.
Yeah, one cool aspect in the film, there's an attic space scene in the film, which you've seen, and the house actually did not have an attic space in it, so we actually had to build a set to mimic the room in the house. So we basically had a fake room to the specs of the real room to be able to get that shot. And within that, I think it's like a 15-second scene. There's like 6 or 7 edits in that one scene there.
Nice. The other thing I was thinking of, and you mentioned the different cameras. There's a little bit of Rashomon to the storytelling. And, yeah, I just dropped Rashomon on a horror film shot in the Midwest. Deal with it. When you were working on the script, do you have that outline as far as let's use this camera, let's use that camera?
Yeah. I kind of wanted to show different points of view in the story. Like we have the police dash cam, we have the interview with Tanner, and then we have Jed and Griffin, who are kind of the main characters that you go back and forth between the cameras on. So yeah, I kind of always had that in my mind to be able to go back and forth to do that.
Okay. And, of course, you did everything on this. I think catering as well.
Wore a lot of hats.
I have to ask, was that your band?
It was.
Just ask it.
I mean, I'll tell you what, it was a surreal experience, that's for sure. It got to the point to where, you know, I always wanted to make a movie, and the only way I was going to be able to get it made, especially in the small town of Sumner where I live, that I was going to have to do a lot of different things. So I just went ahead and just jumped in head first and just decided to roll the dice and see what happened.
Well, okay, so you're talking about your hometown, I'm going to just put, did you get permits? Did the town know you were doing this?
Well, actually, yeah, they did. I'm actually on the volunteer fire department.
Ah.
I'm also on I'm on the city council now as well. But, yeah, so I got a lot of irons in the fire right now. But yeah, they were very much aware of it. And I had the support of the local police department, local fire department. Actually, everybody in the film who were first responders are actual first responders in real life. So, yeah, so that kind of has a little bit of a hint of realism in it as well.
I was going to say, when I saw the trucks, I was like, ooh, production value. What'd you have to get for that?
Yep, yep, just asked, just made a phone call and asked. And actually, my mom is good friends with the coroner, so I was able to get a body bag and, you know, all that stuff. So it really added a lot of realism to the film, for sure.
And there's nothing wrong with beg, borrow, and steal for your art. That's all right.
That's right.
Now, because you also directed this and was acting in it, it's one thing to, and I'm always curious about this, as far as, you know, having the camera set up so you can be in front of it, even though you're also direct, quote unquote, directing behind it. But because it's a found footage, how much emphasis or importance was there of using the movie term hitting the mark?
It's really difficult, especially in a found footage setting. I had an assistant director. How we ended up doing this was I had a digital transmitter on the camera, and my assistant director would be in another room. And whenever I would do a scene, I'd be trying to listen to the dialogue to make sure it flowed the way that I had wanted it and the way it was in the script. And he would be in the other room kind of watching how I was moving the camera. And every time I'd say cut, I'd immediately go back to him and say, okay, so what do you think? And he'd say, oh, I loved how you, you know, how everybody was in focus, or, you know, I liked how you concentrated on this. Won't you do that next time? Just do a little bit more, stuff like that. And he kind of shared the same vision as me. So that really, really helped a lot to be able to have an assistant director, another set of eyes on it, because looking through that little bitty viewfinder on a camera can be kind of tedious sometimes.
I wondered if, and did you draw out anything ahead of time for this?
You mean as far as storyboarding?
Storyboarding,
and stuff?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, for okay. Sure, yeah. There's some key scenes in the film. Let's see, I'm trying to think, the ending sequence.
Yeah, I don't want to give away a whole lot, but there's a couple of moments where I thought that's got to be boarded, because there's a couple of, spoiler alert on a horror film, there's a couple of jump moments that are very effective.
Yeah, yeah, because storyboarding is very important. I mean, there's some people out there that make films like, oh, I don't really want a storyboard, but I wanted to make sure that my cast and crew knew kind of the same vision that I was wanting for the scene, to kind of help it, you know, go better, and for them to be able to understand what I was wanting.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come find the house? Because we all know the house is also a character.
Yes, for sure. The house is actually in Sumner, Illinois, the town I live in. And when I was a kid, I always thought it was such a fascinating house, such a creepy looking house for sure. Had a lot of character to it. And I always had in the back of my mind, like, wow, that'd be such a cool house that, you know, have a scary movie in, or, you know, have a haunted house in. And whenever I was writing Unlisted Owner, I had that house in mind. And the guy who owned it at the time was gracious enough to let us use it, because no one was living in it at the time. So it worked out great.
And when you first went in, were you, as far as testing the rooms, did you do camera tests to see how it could go from one level to another?
Well, I'd actually been in it one other time when I was a kid, so I kind of knew the layout, and I also kind of wrote that into the script, because the house is huge. It's like a three-story house with mm-hmm. a full basement. So the only part I think I hadn't been in was like the basement part and maybe the very, very upstairs. But I knew that it was a big enough house that I could, you know, have a little bit more creative control as far as different rooms, different things happening and stuff, because I knew there was a lot of rooms in the house.
Okay. And shifting gears a little bit, was any of the film improvised with the actors?
There were a few scenes that I'd always let them have a little bit of creative control. Whenever I wrote the script, I had all the main cast sit around and we did a round table read of the whole entire script. And whenever you're writing a script and you kind of know who's going to play the parts, because my friends were pretty much the main cast, and your friends have different mannerisms, different ways they convey things, and different things they like to say, different words they like to use a lot. So I wrote that into the script, and also I used their first names. So that kind of helped with the flow a little bit too. But when we did the roundtable read, like I'd let them say, well, you know, I'd let them, if they thought their character wasn't going to say that, I'd say, okay, well, you know, tell me what you would like it to say, and we'd change it and stuff. And I mean, we had a few things that we added in here and there. So, but for the most part, you know, when you go back and look at the script, I mean, it's pretty much, you know, the flow is exactly how I had it.
Yeah, I saw the cast list, and I kept thinking of the story Tony Danza said. He always played characters named Tony because if they called him something else, he wouldn't turn around.
Yeah, I figured it, because everybody in the film, it was actually their first time acting in a movie. So, I mean, I think people had done plays and stuff like that. For the most part, most of us were pretty green to it. So I wanted to kind of make it as easy as possible and be able to use everybody's first name instead of like, hey, Steve, and they, you know, make it kind of awkward, just kind of let the flow go.
Right. So looking at the timeline, was this shot on weekends?
Yeah, it was. We basically, you said it was shot on weekends, right? Sorry about that.
Yeah, because I noticed, because for folks, there's about a, it took a 2-year span to complete, correct?
Yeah, yeah. We basically shot on the weekends. Everybody had full-time jobs and stuff, and the scheduling was kind of hard. I had a buddy, well, actually Tyler, it's in the film. He's actually a police officer at the time, which is kind of funny. And he was working like every weekend or like one day a weekend. And then Andrea, she was like working every other weekend. So to try to get them in the same scene was kind of difficult sometimes. But we were able to get it. That's the main thing.
And that's got to be hard because not just because of the time and the commitment of others, but also the continuity aspect.
Yeah, for sure. We did have an issue with continuity. There was a scene that after we filmed it, I put it into the editor and realized there was a huge mistake in it, and I needed to reshoot it. And a few months had went by this time, and when I finally got everybody together to shoot it, I think Heidi didn't have her overshirt any longer. Griffin didn't have his glasses because he doesn't really wear glasses, and kind of a pain, especially to find a woman's shirt. Happened to go around to all these different stores saying, I need this shirt. Can you guys have something similar to this? I mean, it's a lot harder than what you would think to try to find something like that.
And how was cast morale as you were going through these weekend shoots?
Oh, we had a blast. I mean, we look back on it now, and I talked to the different people who were in the film, and they look back as like, it's almost like a coming-of-age movie, especially for us. Tyler, he's married and has kids now. I'm married, have a kid on the way. So, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, like us being youthful and having, you know, instead of like, you know, kind of going to the transition of adulthood. So, I mean, it was, you know, we had a blast the whole time. We were always laughing and joking. And, you know, if you get the DVD, you can see the behind the scenes and you're like, wow, how the heck did he make this thing with all this joking around going on?
Now, yeah, I read that I know you had a couple of screenings in Indiana in 2013, and then there was another one with the American Film Market in 2015. Were there any changes that happened because of the focus groups and because of those screenings?
Yeah, actually there was. In 2013, the first focus group showing we did was in Vincennes, Indiana, and we showed it twice. We had 110 people each night, and I passed out surveys. And one of the main things people were wanting to know was about the family of five who moved into the house. So after reading all the feedback, I decided to go back in and I wrote a new beginning sequence to the film because the film originally started with just me, Tyler, and Gavin loading up the vehicle for the camping trip. So I have actually casted some people locally in the area, and we shot the original family of five scene. That's the beginning sequence to the film, which I think really, really helps set the tone for the movie.
And how did the when did you find out you were going to be released on Amazon?
We went to the American Film Market, and submitted screeners to all these different distribution companies. And after we signed our deal with Tomcat Films, Summerhill Films out of Phoenix, they gave us a list of deliverables, and one of the deliverables was basically to create an M&E track for the film. And I'm not sure if you know what an M&E track is, but it's basically all the background sound separated from the dialogue, which a found footage film, it's kind of hard to have someone with a boom mic follow you around, so it's all recorded on the camera. Mm-hmm. So we basically had to recreate every sound effect for the entire 74-minute film, and that took us from February of 17 to July of 17. And once we got that complete, that's when we found out that it was going to be released November 14th on Amazon. So it was a long road for sure.
Can you watch found footage films anymore?
Yeah. Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I haven't watched very many lately because I've been busy with the film and stuff, But I did play a found footage video game of Outlast. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or not, but it's actually like a game, and you have like a handheld camera, and it's a pretty neat game for sure. But that's probably the most recent found footage involved thing that I've done here lately.
Do you have another script in the works?
I have several scripts ready to go, even an unlisted owner too. But it just kind of depends on the funding we get from unlisted owner, depending on which direction we choose. I mean, I would love to shoot a traditionally shot film. The main reason we did found footage on this this time is because of funding. So hopefully, okay, fingers crossed, we'll be able to make enough to be able to put into it to make a traditionally shot film next time.
And you said you have a child on the way?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, Jace Bryan is going to be due May 30th.
And how old before you show Jace this film?
He may have to get a little bit bigger.
I think?
Yeah, I don't want to have to, you know, especially the wife might be mad having him having nightmares, so don't want to do that.
As the father of a 16-year-old, I can tell you, I will give you this parental advice. You can watch anything in the first year.
Okay, all
because
right, awesome.
She has not, my daughter has not brought up watching The Wild Bunch. So I figured if she would have by now. So
yeah,
I would say the first year, although you might get what I like to use the term sitcom wife look. But I think the first year you'll be okay.
All right. Awesome. I'll put that down.
That was my chat with filmmaker Jed Bryan, whose film Unlisted Owner is now available on video, and I think it's available on streaming. I still like physical copies of music. I'm that person. All right, we're near the tail end of this week's show, and I want to thank everybody for hanging out and listening to the program and trying not to do too much of therapy on the air with the last couple weeks. But I owe myself a correction. I didn't even say this on the air, but I guess this is also a public service announcement. There is a film composer named Brian May. It is not Brian May of Queen. He's an Australian filmmaker, considered one of the best composers in Australian cinema. And it was, and I bring this up because I forgot that it was somebody else. It's not the guitarist from Queen that did the music to Mad Max and the Road Warrior. So my own mental mistake, and don't mistake yourself as well. This is a gentleman who did films like Dick Down Under, Patrick, the first Mad Max, One More Minute, Barnaby and Me, which was, I thought it was a TV movie. I don't know if it got a release in theaters in Australia or in the United States or vice versa, but it was Juliet Mills and Sid Caesar and a koala. Not kidding. Films like Thirst, Stage Fright, Road Games, that's the highway version of Rear Window with Stacey Keach and Jamie Lee Curtis, and it was shot in Australia in the outback, in the desert. And this was also a period. There's a really fun documentary called Not Quite Hollywood, and it's about the Australian exploitation films before The Road Warrior. And there was also a period where you had a lot of Australian films with American and English stars, which kind of irked the Australian actors. But anyway, Brian May, not of Queen, also did the music for The Survivor, Treasure of the Yankee Zephyr, which is another American-English actor film with an all-Australian crew, The Road Warrior from 1981, of course, Breakfast in Paris, 1982, Turkey Shoot, Kitty and the Bagman, Cloak and Dagger, yes, Henry Thomas and Dabney Coleman. This was Henry Thomas's big film after E.T., Missing in Action 2, The Beginning, Sky Pirates, that brief period where they tried to get Robert Urich to be a film star. Death Before Dishonor, that period where they tried to make Fred Dreyer a movie star. He has already done Hunter as the ex-football player. Blood Moon, Steel Dawn, oh my gosh, yeah, Dead Sleep. He also did Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, Hurricane Smith, the Carl Weathers in Australia in an action film, 19 and in his last feature film 1992's Dr. Giggles. So all of these composed by Australian film composer Brian May, not the guitarist of Queen. My mistake there. And apparently, Mr. May is also credited. It says music department, so take that for have to find out what the fine line is there. But he also did additional music on Gallipoli, was the music coordinator on 1980s The Blue Lagoon. You got to work out somewhere. So anyway, all of that and all. Just a little clarification for everybody there. Well, the clock on the wall says film sociology is over for now, but it sounds like the house party. Some of us are sleeping in. But I want to thank everybody for listening to the show. While we're in the shameless plug department, if you're listening on Saturday, 7:30 at Earlham College, the production of Much Ado About Nothing is going to be having their final performance. And this is directed by my lovely wife, Lynn Perkins. And there are two really fun versions of this play on film. One that everybody knows, directed by Kenneth Branagh and starring Kenneth Branagh as Benedict and his then wife Emma Thompson as Beatrice. You also have Michael Keaton as Dogberry, Keanu Reeves as Don John, Denzel Washington as Don Pedro. This is Robert Sean Leonard was Claudio, and Kate Beckinsale was the first thing that she got noticed in playing Hero, along with a great slew of that guys and those ladies. A fun romp shot in southern Italy. And then on the flip side, Joss Whedon, after he did the first Avengers film, if I remember correctly, did a version of Much Ado About Nothing, modern dress, black and white, has a same story, just a completely different feel and tone. And while the Branagh's Much Ado sound looks and feels like a summer vacation in Italy where you're wearing white cotton and having wine and fruit and cheese, and then you're doing Shakespeare. I mean, who wouldn't want to take that job? And while it has that summer romp feel to it, the Joss Whedon version feels like a weekend cocktail party. I believe it was shot in his house, very low budget, but a nice contrast. Not as heightened emotionally as the other one, but just as effective. So anyway, you have options out there for you. But yeah, the stage version of Much Ado is happening at Earlham College Saturday night at 7:30 p.m., directed by my lovely wife, Lynn. And Falling is happening in mid-January at Richmond Civic Theater. I'll bring that up closer. I'm acting in it, but the more important thing is it's being directed by my daughter, Emma. So when it gets closer, we'll be shamelessly plugging that. All right, with that in mind, we're going to wrap things up with what I feel is the best use of Queen in a film, and we talked about this earlier. I love the use of Don't Stop Me Now in Shaun of the Dead, so we're going to end the show with that. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent Green is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. You have Bohemian Rhapsody. You have Can You Ever Forgive Me? Both of those are definitely worth checking out. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. Feel alive, and the world turning inside out. Yeah. I'm floating around in ecstasy, so
don't stop me now. Don't stop me,
'cause I'm having a good time,
having a good time.
Shooting star, leaping through the sky. Get the
supersonic woman of you.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!